Hey everyone, it's Kale Smith here, host and creator of In Movies We Grow. Today, we are going to be looking at Tyler Scruggs. He is a very good friend of mine, always has interesting ideas about meta-narratives in films, and in-depth looks into queer media and LGBTQ stories that are, populating kind of now more than ever in our zeitgeist. And you will kind of hear a little bit of our discussion about Love, Victor a little bit at the beginning of this episode, but that's beside the point. Tyler is a great person. He always has had these interesting opinions on our media, and I think it's time we hear him out about where those interesting ideas, the personality of his, comes from. So, thanks everyone for tuning in for episode 4. I hope you enjoy it. It's a long one, unfortunately, but listening to it, I couldn't really cut anything out that I found important. Maybe Tyler could have, but that's beside the point. Not every episode will be as long, but that's in either here or there. Thanks everyone for listening, and please give your full attention to Tyler Scruggs and listening on how movies grew him. So tell me more. So why is Love, Victor not great, Tyler?
I mean, it's not that it's not great, it's just not good. And I mean that in the sense that I never had high expectations or hopes for Love, Victor. I just wanted something that wasn't actively harmful. And I will give it like the credit that, like, no, it is not an actively harmful show, but it is very queer baity in the sense that, like, the majority of season one does require you to invest solely in heterosexual relationships, up until episode 8 of 10, when things get, from the questioning to the sort of action. It's almost like we meet him prematurely, and the first season doesn't have the plot to really captivate you through the end. So, like, it holds out on the coming out and, kind of the good stuff with, or like the stuff that you came to see the show for until the very end of the series, which is a strategy. It's not the first show to like hold back on the goods until the last 3 episodes. But as far as teen high school dramas go, you're gonna have to do better than that to get me to co-sign, endorse it, and like, rave about it, especially in this new climate.
Well, for me, it seems anti-progressive to have that structure. Or it see it doesn't seem as progressive on that end to not have to not be just up in front about it and not be. I mean, maybe because even Love, Simon, it's very much the character is gay, like it's a.
Yeah, so like when we meet Simon, like Simon himself is like, I'm gay, I am just in the closet, and I don't feel like I can tell anyone. So like that's an instant conflict that like requ that needs a resolution, not 8 episodes from then, but like an hour or so into the film or whatever, whenever he comes out. With Love, Victor, it's a more interesting premise. It's a far more interesting premise. It's, oh, I'm frustrated because my parents aren't accepting of gay people. They don't know that I'm gay yet, but most of all, I don't know whether I'm gay yet. And I have a crush on this guy, but I also have a crush on this girl, and maybe I'll start dating this girl for a while. And like, I don't know how to like compartmentalize or understand these feelings. And like, that could have been something that carried the show, and it was something that the show did implement, obviously, but it was so disappointing to see it all culminate into him spending all this time talking about the spectrum of sexuality and queerness and like all of this internal dialogue and research, just for him to be like in a knee-jerk reaction tell his parents that he's gay. And
that's it.
Like, it's cut to black. That's the end of the first season. And like, I saw it coming a mile away, obviously, but I was disappointed a mile away too. And I know that that was there not as a storytelling device, but as a marketing tool, where it's like, thank you for watching season one of Love, Simon. Now we can get to what we actually advertised in season two. And I understand that gimmick, that behavior, but you still need that solid first season. Because I'm like season two of Love, Victor is not going to be on my radar. And it's not, I'm not going to rush to see it. I don't know if I will see it. And that's entirely because I gave them the chance with the first one, you know, like
we gave you 5 hours already. So
I gave you 5 hours on top of an hour and a half of Love, Simon. Like, cool movie, but like, that is not like, we now have one Lord of the Rings of Love, Simon cinematic universe content, and like, how much story? I don't know.
Well, and what's even more frustrating is there's more to the story than just coming out.
Exactly. There's so much more.
Way much more.
It was just so reductive to the show. Like, the show had its sights set on something beyond what Love, Simon offered, but then gave us something more regressive.
Yeah, I mean, I understand we're coming at it from, you know, our mid-20s, and we've had time to deal. We've had, like, seasons worth of, drama to deal, or obstacles to deal with. But I feel like Love, Victor should be an opportunity to go deeper into that. Like, we had the coming out story. Now here's a person that is coming out or trying to come out. And here are the struggles that are going to come with it.
Exactly. I think this show is under the impression that it achieved that, but that's where I come in to say, no, you didn't.
oh, well.
Better luck next time, you know, Stan High Fidelity is what I say.
Yeah, I should watch that too. That was another Disney Plus thing that got moved to Hulu.
Yeah.
Because Disney Plus is, I guess, afraid to talk about real issues.
High Fidelity is way gayer, way more fun, much, much, much better story. And like, that show is based on a movie, which is based on a book. It's very self-contained, but opens the window, you know, opens the door to a second season, but I am very satisfied and happy with the season that I have already. So like, when the next one comes around, I may not rush to see that one either, but I'm thinking good things. Like, oh, I remember that great night I watched all of High Fidelity. And I think this was actually what coming around to this podcast and like where you're going with it, I'm able to think of the movies that influenced me and informed me the most, because they were always events in the sense that they were, even if they were just trips to the theater, they were things that like I actively anticipated, thought exclusively about, and like the movie impressed me enough to where it changed me like in the trajectory towards that franchise or towards that idea or ideology. And I worry that in this binge culture, like the days blend into one another and so is the content. Like,
you're worried you're going to get High Fidelity mixed up with Love, Victor.
Like, you know, because they're both two 5-hour blocks of me sitting on the couch at home or looking at my iPad. They are not like sentimental memories that I hold. Like, I will always forget the time that I watched High Fidelity because it's not designed, I don't think it's designed to be remembered almost. It's designed to be watched.
Right.
And yeah.
So you're going to move on to the next thing, which is what they were going to recommend you afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. Could you imagine if like a movie, like even if you attended a double feature, like if the next feature started like immediately after the first one, like without no intermission or just
no
even
bathroom break,
no bathroom break. It just started. That would be ridiculous, but that's definitely the planet we're gonna live on. Oh, by the way, did you see the Cinemark thing where you can rent out a theater? It's like $100 and you can take 20 people to a socially distant movie.
Yeah, so Georgia Theater Company is also doing the same thing that you can invite like 20 people and you can all watch a movie either at the Cinemark, like you mentioned, or in Athens, Georgia, where at the University 16, and watch like just some randomly selected movie.
Yeah, I think I read it was a small pool, I'm remembering now.
A lot of DC movies are on there, though.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like Aquaman, Wonder Woman, the Burton Batman movie. I don't think Batman v Superman's on there, but I know there's a bunch of DC WB related films.
Okay, well, I don't think I'm gonna get out of the house for any of those. So.
Oh well, yeah. Oh well.
Or host a party. Hey guys, come to my Wonder Woman party.
Come to my late party where we watch Aquaman on the big screen again. Yeah. So getting into that, what was that first, not necessarily event, but first movie for you? What was the first movie you remember seeing?
I definitely was engulfed in the world of Toy Story from a very early age. My parents told me that they took me to see it, but I was not old enough to cognitively remember it. And I've always tried to figure out what day they took me on. I was born in January of 95. Toy Story came out September of 95. I don't think they took a baby that young to the movies, but it might have been into the fall or winter season where I would have been almost a year old. Nevertheless, I do have like I have a lot of Toy Story memorabilia. I have a sealed Buzz Lightyear, and kind of throughout my life, Toy Story has always been like congruent with my coming of age. Even like Toy Story, you know, like Toy Story 3 was very close to my high school graduation. Toy Story 4 was very close to my existential crisis. I have a beautiful kinship with Toy Story, and I'm glad that that has remained untainted in a lot of ways compared to other franchises. But you know, as I turned 5 or 6, I was just kind of the perfect age for the boom of the superhero and the franchise. Like, I was 5 years old when The Phantom Menace came out. So, like, I was the target audience for The Phantom Menace. I, you know, the Taco Bell toys, the action figures, all that jazz, the posters. I was Anakin Skywalker for Halloween. Like, I had a homemade costume. Like, I was 100% all about it. And then not, 2 years later, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone came out, and I was already being read. It's a cute story. Like, my dad, who worked long nights in the car business, he would come home late at night, so we didn't really have like a bedtime. You know, he would want to read to us, but he wouldn't want to, or like, it'd be so late into the night that like he would kind of wake us up to read to me. And I say us, but it was mostly me. And he had just heard of this book, Harry Potter, that like kids were really into. And so he purchased what was then like the newest entry, Goblet of Fire, and would read me, like, I just have this strong memory of being read the first one or two chapters of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire.
Oh, wow.
By my father. And it was 2001. I was, you know, 6 or 7. And I saw an ad on TV, I think, for Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. And then I made the connection. I ran and grabbed the book, and I was like, Harry Potter, Harry Potter. So I mean, I was wise beyond my years and had internet access at a very early age. Like, I was typing in AOL keyword Harry Potter from a very, very young, like a dangerously young age. But then it was just kind of off to the races, because I remember I had are you familiar with the Leapster pad?
Yes, I am. Leapster, yeah.
So I had the Leapster pad. But there was like a premium version of the Leapster pad where it was a subscription service, I think, to some extent. It was like a month, it was like almost like a magazine. It was more magazine like, but still the Leaps, it was like compatible with Leapster. And there was a Harry Potter one, and it was like the summer of sequels, 2002. I'm having this thing like read to me, but like I'm reading what's essentially like IMDb for babies, where it's like, in 2002, Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, Spider-Man 2, Attack of the Clones. Like, it listed out all of these like sequels that came out in 2002.
Yeah,
The Two Towers. And I was like, oh my god, it's my, like, I love all these movies. And so, like, I rode the hype train, and that didn't stop until well into adulthood. I was just always hyped up for the most hyped up thing. And you can kind of see that trend throughout the years of the movies that made the most impact to me. But then, and feel free to interrupt if you want to get to a specific question. But then I got into like indie film, in like, because it was like 2004 when Napoleon Dynamite came out, and that was kind of like
a game changer
in a lot of ways, not just for independent cinema, but just like independent cinema consumption, or like, oh, like, this movie is weird. Like, I didn't know movies could be weird. Like, because all the movies that I had watched before were very like, may have been weird in their own right or in a certain capacity, like Sam Raimi's Spider-Man, but they weren't Napoleon Dynamite weird. And then I think that's what kind of got me into the idea of like behind the scenes, like writers and directors and stuff, and kind of understanding, oh, like when 2007 rolls around, it's like, oh, Nacho Libre, that's from the people who made Napoleon Dynamite. Like, I know what to expect from that film. to a certain degree because of how funny and weird Napoleon Dynamite was, and early Wes Anderson, you know, like that. That's kind of how my hipster brain started to, you know, because I always had this like hyped up mainstream brain, but also this brooding, isolating hipster brain.
All right. And so we'll put a button on Jared Hess and Wes Anderson. We'll come back to it in a second. Sure. But I wanted to go back to 2002 because, well, and also a little bit of 2001 because that was influential for us because of Harry Potter. But 2002, I don't think people from older generations understand how impactful this summer of 2002 was, because, you know, in that same summer you had, you opened with Spider-Man and then you kind of tailed end it with Men in Black 2.
Yeah.
And Stuart Little 2, which was huge for my 8-year-old brain, because I loved the first movie. And I mean, you just, so what do you remember a lot of that from that, not necessarily that summer, but really from that whole year, because that was a huge year. And I don't think it gets a lot of credit because a lot of people have kind of poo-pooed on it. I don't know what, because I don't, what, did Chicago come out that year or did something else come out that year?
I think it was Chicago. That came out the year the first Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Or the second, or Spider-Man 2, rather. It was weird. It came at a time when sequels were noticeably picking up speed.
Again.
In this, again, in the sense that, like, Spider-Man 1 and 2 came out back-to-back, summer-wise.
2 years
Harry
apart.
Harry Potter... Were they 2 years apart? Mm-hmm. So what's the first Spider-Man 2000?
2002, and then Spider-Man 2 was 2004.
So was it 2004 that was the summer of movies?
I mean, there was a summer of sequels, too, in 2004. Like, you had Shrek 2, Prisoner of Azkaban.
Prisoner of Azkaban.
Yeah. Spider-Man 2. No, Incredibles was November, so...
Oh, and then there was this, the subsequent Pixar films, which I was also following studiously, and those were coming at a very noticeable every 3-year cycle up until... Was it Toy Story 2? Toy Story 2 was 99... And then Finding Nemo was...
You're forgetting one in the middle. Monsters, Inc.
Oh, what's 2001?
Monsters, Inc. is 2001. And then 2003 is Finding Nemo.
Yes. So I remember... Because I'm thinking of like the physical things that I... Like the tactile things that I remember because I watched these movies on not an iPad and in theaters.
I am like, too, and I don't know why I keep remembering all these dates.
Like, I remember going back to the theater where do you remember going back to the theater for bonus content? Like when Monsters, Inc. had a re-release with like additional scenes and like bloopers and shit. And then, where did they do that again? Where it was like, they just did a re-release not long after the release of the film.
And you're not talking about the 3D re-releases, right?
No, though these were like that one was probably like the Thanksgiving holiday season of 2001. So around the time that Chamber of Secrets, or I'm sorry, Sorcerer's Stone was out, I also have this strong memory of my dad taking me to see Will Smith's Ali. and towards the end, being allowed to go across the theater to catch the end of Sorcerer's Stone. And I had already seen Sorcerer's Stone, so it was cool. God, I was so young, and my dad was just like,
"Were y'all in like in a small town?" The
theater. No, and it was actually I was thinking about this when I was thinking back to these like theaters in Tucson, Arizona. There was one theater that's closed down now, and it'd be the one that I would go to most frequently. There was it was off the freeway, like yeah, it was off I-10 on Grant, and it was notable because it was probably within between a tenth and a quarter of a mile from like the on-ramp, and it was a hot spot for carjackings.
Oh my goodness.
Because you could carjack a car. you could steal a car and get on the freeway while someone's in the theater, and like 2 hours later they are long, like they're already to Phoenix. So as far as
you would know.
As far as you would know, where they would be down, I mean, 2 hours south of Tucson is, you know, the border to Mexico. So, like, they could go anywhere.
Yeah.
So, that theater is no longer in business, but I saw many, 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 many films there, as well as at the Park Place Mall. And it's at the Park Place Mall that I'm trying to recall, you know, seeing... Monsters Inc. I have strong memories of seeing Spy Kids 3D, all the Spy Kids films.
No one's talked about Spy Kids yet, which was huge.
I stan Spy Kids, like hardcore fan.
I was such a hardcore fan. Loved it. That was, you know, you talk about extended or re-releases. That's the one movie I did actually go and see. When it was
a re-release, wasn't it? And that was 2001.
Yes.
The first one. Okay. Yes. Yeah, Spy Kids, you know, it was another franchise, but it was also like always this scrappy underdog franchise. Even at the time, it was like, yeah, like you've got a McDonald's deal, but that's like the extent of it. Like everyone hates you for no reason. I just remember being really defensive of it, and I remember wearing those 3D glasses that came with the film way too long.
Oh, I thought they were cool.
I loved them so much that like I have permanent like eye damage because I have permanent red and blue like hues. Not so much anymore, but I do remember, that's a true story, I remember looking at the sun wearing like the red and blue 3D glasses and like taking them off and seeing the colors like kind of still there and like burnt in, and I was very young and I was like and then like I kind of, you know, covering one eye, I was able to see the red shade and the blue shade, and I kind of still can
if you really think hard about it.
Yeah, although like I mean I can definitely tell that this is more the orangey vibe coming out of this eye, and this is the cooler tones.
Yeah, I remember what's cool about the re-release too was they announced the sequel that was coming that year later.
Yeah. And was Game Over 2003?
Yes.
So that was like bam, bam, bam. And then, maybe what, like 2 years later, we had Shark Boy and Lava Girl, which is mm-hmm. different. I was a fan of at the time. Like, I was like into it. But it's a whole different beast then.
Well, for me, like, Robert Rodriguez is one of our influential directors because ours was, of course, Shark Boy, Lava Girl, and Spy Kids. But then you get older and you watch his adult films and his more like Westerns and, you know, in Sin City, of course. And you're like, this dude really was an innovative director.
Absolutely.
You know, And to your point, while he was making these Spy Kid movies, he was making like Once Upon a Time in Mexico. He was experimenting with digital cameras. He made Sin City, which was another ground. He actually made Sin City and Sharkboy and Lava Girl in the same year.
That's iconic, honestly.
I mean, the dude was busy.
Yeah, that's incredible. Although I guess his son did most of the heavy lifting.
He wrote the script. He wrote it with... He said, yeah, his son wrote in front of the typewriter for days on end.
I wonder if his son's like on Twitter or something.
He has multiple children that work with him.
Yeah, but I just remember him being like our age. I just discovered John C. Reilly's like pretty boy rapper son.
Yeah.
I don't know how I feel about that, but it kind of reminds me of, it vaguely reminds me of like Chet Hanks and just the strange 180s that children of famous people make with their brand identities.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just,
no, it's interesting. Well,
I'm just wondering what he's up to now, post Sharkboy and Lava Girl.
Who knows? But he helped write a really. I think, yeah. I don't think Sharkboy and Lava Girl is like, you know, an Oscar-winning screenplay. But I mean, it was a fun movie to watch when you're a kid. I haven't seen it since like in like 10 years.
I haven't seen it in a very long time either, and I wonder how or if it holds up, but now that I think about it, I'm down to see any movie in 3D. Like if you hand me a 3D movie and say, here, watch this, it kind of doesn't matter what it is, I will get down with it.
Tenet or Christopher Nolan will open the theaters if you put Tenet in 3D or
I'm
kidding, of course.
I mean, Christopher Nolan is missing out by being so reluctant to utilize 3D. I saw the Batman Still Rises.
The Dark Knight Rises.
The Dark Knight Rises and The Amazing Spider-Man in the same theater, like in the same seat within like weeks of each other. And you know which one I have stronger memories of? The Amazing Spider-Man, because that shit was in IMAX 3D, and it's so fun watching 3D shit, and I will continue to stand 3D while also standing like people's right to not have 3D.
So let me ask you this. Why do you love 3D so much?
I love the technology, especially, and I don't know if we want to leave this early 2000s era, but like especially come, you know, the rise of 3D, that very much changed how I go to the movies, why I go to the movies, what movies I decide to see in theaters. Because as 3D started picking up, I started to go to 3D movies more and 2D movies less, because I couldn't simulate the experience of 3D at home. So not only would I see the 3D movie, I would see the 3D movie. I would only see the movie in 3D, at like the first time, and then subsequently I would see it in 3D if I want to, which I know is not congruent with how the market responded to 3D, but you know, that's why we have little VR headsets, so I can watch 3D whenever I want.
Right. Well, I mean, for on my side of the coin, I don't hate 3D. I think it can be utilized perfectly in movies like Life of Pi, Gravity, even Gemini Man had really good 3D.
I wish I had seen it in 3D.
Yeah, I think there are directors that have utilized 3D perfectly But I think the issue is it just got so overdone. And then on top of that, you know, you and I
done so poorly.
Right. I mean, there was poor imitations that, you know, and of course, if you saw a poor imitation and you had to pay, you know, for some people, they had to pay $20.
Yeah. There were many bad 3D movies. I just defaulted to seeing them in 3D. And then, like, the 3D was poor. Like, I saw The Last Airbender opening day in 3D.
It was
among the worst 3D I've ever seen. I can't say it was the worst 3D I've ever seen.
What's the worst?
Oh, God. What have I seen in 3D? I saw Green Lantern in 3D.
I saw that too in 3D.
That one was rough. I saw... This is a good example, but same year, Yogi Bear. That was a good example of 3D. I liked the Yogi Bear with Dan Aykroyd and Justin Timberlake. If I recall correctly, I don't remember. But I do remember the 3D being well done. Did I see Piranha 3D? I saw the worst 3D movie of them all in 3D. The Nutcracker. Are you familiar with this film? Oh my
god. Which one is it? There's been a couple.
It's titled The Nutcracker in 3D. Starring Nathan Lane as Albert Einstein.
Oh, that came out like in 2011?
Yes.
Oh my god.
I saw that in theaters in 3D.
I've read so many terrible reviews on that one. Like, wow.
Yeah, it's horrifying. In fact, that might be the content this Christmas. I'm gonna work on my video essay for the Nutcracker in 3D.
Oh my god.
And time for that. Because that movie's insane. Like, we've got Nazi rats. We've got original lyrics to the tune of classic Nutcracker songs, like the Nutcracker Suite song is sung by Nathan Lane, who plays Albert Einstein. It's about the children of Albert Einstein. Nathan Lane sings, like, I'm doing like funny mm-hmm. Nathan Lane poses, like E=mc², like those are the lyrics to the song. Like,
sounds terrible.
It's like the theory of relativity, it's full on musical, god awful CGI, god, like, just horrifying to watch, like, truly demented and dark. And I might be overselling it, but I do remember that being, circling back around, one of the first movie reviews I've ever written was for that film. And I think I could find that somewhere. I'm sure I have that file still, and I wonder what my old thoughts were on it.
Like, is it published, or do you just like wrote it and kept it in the
file? I wrote it, published it somewhere. I remember sharing it with my film teacher, like, in high school.
What inspired you to write reviews?
What inspired me to write reviews? I was always kind of like a gigantic critic. I remember staging a protest against like those Scholastic book fairs, because I felt that the pricing was unfair. And I remember making signs like on the playground. And this is just kind of like the type of kid I was, while concurrently like writing comic books and reading I would read the class book way ahead of everyone. Like, I would finish the book like you know, you're supposed to spend like 10 weeks reading every chapter, but like I'd read it all in 2 weeks and just like kind of smugly sit in the back of the class like, I know how it ends. I know how the book ends. But I didn't start writing reviews until high school. It had to have been high school. And it was like just such a big boom in movies. Like, I finished middle school the summer of Iron Man and the Dark Knight. So that was kind of like the year important people took superheroes seriously, in the sense that like Oscar attention and just like a lot of mainstream, you know, it was like the birth of the MCU and just sort of like the serious like Dark Knight stuff, gritty realism. And it was like at that age,
gritty realism,
that like I started getting into darker, grittier films, yeah, I think it was like 2009 when I saw Fight Club for the first time. And I was like a freshman in high school. So it was like a freshman in high school seeing Fight Club for the first time. So I was kind of that. I was that kid. We were all like,
what did you think?
Fight Club, in my geeky as fuck, like high school circle, we were obsessed with Fight Club. Like, we would talk about Fight Club all the time. We would watch it multiple times. In a good way.
In a good way or a bad way?
There were many months where it was like objectively the best movie of all time in our eyes. I don't think we had like a proper reading of it. And I don't think I got like a very mature reading of it until way later in life. But that was also like, it was just kind of the year where I started making movies, like 2009. I was in a film class. We were talking about movies a lot, and I just felt like I had to speak up about my movies and my passions and like why I like things. And like, I always came from like this defensive place almost, which I'm sure a lot of people on Twitter can relate to. And it was also just kind of the advent of social media. So like social media, I would see a lot of movies. I would be really obsessed with like the radio promotional, like advanced screeners, and like using like GoFobo or whatever, and like getting those radio promotion tickets to see a film a couple weeks early. And I had kind of figured out how to game it, especially in the age of Twitter. So like I started to figure out how to use Twitter to secure tickets to movies, that like, so I could just know at like whoever is giving away the tickets, like I can find it. And that really started ticking up in 2010. And that was when like my movie consumption skyrocketed. I was going to screenings like two or three times a week, and I just had nothing to do otherwise. And like, I could walk from my high school after school straight to the mall. And, you know, sometimes I'd get in line at 3:30, 4 o'clock for a 7 p.m. movie. And like, I got connected with this whole like community and subculture of people who like go to those screenings all the time, and the people who camp out and like hold the line for their friends and all that jazz. Is very strange, but I got to see many movies. Like, I saw Scott Pilgrim 3 times before it came out in theaters. And I really thought that it was going to be this gigantic success and just be like this, the coolest film ever made. But alas, it wasn't. And it was my best friends, my best friend Dempsey, really got, he was kind of the one who turned me on to like just genre sci-fi horror, like Aliens and Terminator. And so I was just coming with that whole, you know, just like the cool shit that boys like, 1980s attitude, comic books and all.
Yeah.
And then kind of had this quirky, sensitive side with, you know, through like the Nacho Libre, Napoleon Dynamite, Wes Anderson, 500 Days of Summer, when those kind of, I feel like those kind of culminated in 2010, which I think was like the last best year for movies. 2010. The sheer caliber of Toy Story 3, Inception, Scott Pilgrim, The Social Network, Black Swan, Tron Legacy, The Fighter, Iron Man 2. No, I do remember Iron seeing Man that movie 2. In theaters, but I didn't see the first one in theaters, actually.
I think I've seen all the MCU movies. I think
that might be a complete list. Who knows?
That's just me. Who knows? But yeah, regarding 2010, it was, The Social Network was my favorite movie of the last decade. So if we're thinking that far ahead, and I saw this movie, I saw The Social Network in theaters. I showed it to my parents. I mean, I really loved this movie, and I wasn't even a big Facebook person when I was a kid. Actually, I think Social Network got me in. It was like, yeah, fine, I'll finally get on Facebook, everyone, so you can follow what I do or whatever. Because I wasn't into social media back then, and then, you know, The Social Network changed everything. And then I watched that movie now, and it's like, oh yeah, this was all bad.
And The Social Network, I don't know if that was my first exposure to, like, The Social Network was a whole thing for me. Like, I just got rid of my Social Network t-shirt that I got from a promotional screening. I had a Social Network poster up in my wall, like on my wall, and it really turned me on to the writing of Aaron Sorkin, which got me into television. And I think it was television that kept me hooked on movies for so long, if that makes sense. We're noticing this right now, or I'm noticing this in myself.
Right.
Like
the less that
movies period are part of the cultural conversation, like my interest in them is waning with it. And I don't know what to do about that or with that. Obviously movie output has slowed significantly. There's no shortage of movies to watch, and it's actually been very freeing to kind of watch whatever I want, and not necessarily be beholden to watching and writing and reading about the things that the corporations are putting out every week. I could be like, oh, I saw this, you know, I saw this old movie, I saw this old TV show. And maybe that's just like the brain worms in me that like have been on Twitter for 12, 13 years. But like, it's a big clash of like, I start writing, so I have to start publishing, but I can't really publish movie reviews of whatever I want. I gotta, you know, if I want clicks, I gotta write about the things people want to click on. And so I gotta narrow my scope to these certain movies. Every week I gotta write about the movie that's coming out. I gotta go see it on Thursday, write about it all night, publish it Friday morning, and like do that every week until some neckbeard in Austin, Texas notices me and like wants to have me write for them or something. And I'm over that game for sure. I love Letterboxd for that reason, because you know what movie reviews I read now? Whatever movie I look up on Letterboxd, and it's usually what like some movie that I'm interested in. Doesn't matter if other people are interested in it, and like, oh, my friends have rated it this. That may inform whether I keep watching. But like, when I'm on Letterboxd, it's because, oh, I just started a movie that looks kind of interesting. I want to learn everything about it while I'm watching it. And I don't know if that's appropriate behavior, but that's the behavior that I take on, especially when I'm home. I just find myself learning while I'm watching things, almost to the degree that like Amazon has this feature, but even on the Kindle, like when you're reading something like an ebook, you press and hold, you know, like you can Google, you can look up the term like in the dictionary if you don't know it, or you could Google the term and like read the whole Wikipedia page. Like I don't think people realize that like that the behavior of consumption is changing, whereas like otherwise, you know, if I'm on a beach and I'm reading a book physically and I don't know what something is, I'm either skipping it, making something up that I can project as to like what this thing is, you know, my based on inferences or, you know, context clues, or, you know, stop reading and be like, oh, I don't know what this is, so like I'm gonna stop reading. But now we can read a fact, and then go fact check it. Or like, you know, I'm probably going to learn about whatever I'm watching now. And I don't know if that's, you know, that's not the behavior in a theater. And I think that's the behavior that I'm kind of missing out on, is like, theaters are like, it's going to play whether you're paying attention or not. You paid for it, like, pay attention. Whereas I have so much control over the art when I'm home, like even in terms of consumption, like I'm approaching it from a different perspective of like, it's me and the internet watching, not just me, if that makes sense.
Yes, because I mean, at home, I mean, when I watch a movie at home, I'm usually going to eat something, or we all eat popcorn and drink or whatever, pretzels, whatever. But I mean, I'm eating a full meal at home. I'm, you know, going to have drinks. I'm going to be on my phone during, you know, a slow part of the or a movie that I thought, or a scene that, you know, you would think is slow, or what would you think is slow? And then you, so I mean, we have total control, and I think that's why streaming may or may not be a threat. Because I mean, I've seen movies on my computer, on my TV, where I just watched the whole way through, like just sat on a bed or a couch or whatever, and just, you know, watched the whole thing. You know, I did the same thing with Staten Island recently. Of course I did it with Artemis Fowl, because it was, you know, a 90-minute movie, but it felt like 3 years mm-hmm. long. Yeah, I think what would happen is, if we continue on with your theory, is that patience would go out more. So a movie would have to grab you in the first 2 or 3 minutes in a way, so you would stay on to the plot. So like prologues would now have to be essential.
Yeah. Prologues. Well, I think we're seeing this change in the craft of movies themselves. Like movies are getting longer and longer, and People may be resistant to that. I'm resistant.
Not much longer than what they used to. I mean, Gone with the Wind was 4.5 hours long.
You've got Gone with the Wind and, like, you know, two-act films, you know, with intermissions and stuff. And maybe Tarantino is more an exception to the rule. But, like, you look at Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with, like, Rise of Skywalker or Endgame, like, the palatability for mainstream long form cinema is there. And I think it's going to be the big differential between movies you pay to see in theaters and movies you watch at home, in terms of scope. Because, like, I think I'd be more inclined to put my phone away for 3 hours and watch a long form film then that, you know, is very intentional, you know, almost like a Midsummer. Midsummer was super long, and, like, the director's cut was even longer.
Almost 3 hours. Yeah.
So, like, your options are to either make a 90-minute film, a 3-hour film, or a limited series, or a, you know, multi-season show. And I think a lot of the scripts that would be otherwise fantastic films are ending up becoming limited series and expounded upon. And so I can't really fault the story for wanting to be longer. You know, it makes more sense to make a limited series in a lot of ways because people are employed longer. You have more content, it's slightly, like, it's less expensive to make 10 episodes of the same show, you know, to equate to 10 hours of content than it would be to make 5 movies, like, just in terms of production. Mm-hmm. So I can't, you know, it's where it's headed. I just hope that cinema adapts, like, they still can use the form of cinema to get different new stories across. And I think for all its faults, like, the MCU and the Star Wars sequel trilogy did a lot of those things in the sense that it created an industry within the franchises, like, you know, those were the comic book tie-ins and the book tie-ins and the video game tie-in, like, all the tie-ins and all the little Easter eggs that, like, turn into content for other people's articles, other people's YouTube, like, to where, you know, those movies kind of become a projection of whatever people want to project onto them. And they're designed to be just vague enough and just different enough to garner your interest and also not rock the boat too much in terms of their broader impacts on the universe that they're creating. And I don't know. I've really had to reexamine how I look at and how I consume all sorts of media, movies notwithstanding. But I do know that there is still a power in cinema. I just don't know if it's being utilized, especially in this quarantine era.
Well, it can't be.
I hear it can't be, and I hear the argument, like, you know, the David Lynch, like, you think you've seen a phone, you've seen a film on your fucking cell phone? Get real. That's, like, one of his famous little rants against consuming things on an iPad. I think virtual reality is honestly a solution. We were talking about this earlier, Kale, about live streams and, like, watch parties and stuff. The most effective and best watch parties I've ever attended have been in virtual reality, where I used to have, I don't have a headset anymore, But I used to have like an Oculus Go. I think that's what it was called, Oculus Go. It was like the entry level VR headset. And I made myself an avatar, and I could go, you know, I went to a theater and they were watching like Scary Movie 2 in the virtual theater. And, you know, I could look to my literal left and right and see other avatars. And I was in a voice chat with everyone else watching. And so like I'm in a virtual reality theater. And if I look the way that I would look up at a screen, I would see a screen playing a movie and no popcorn on the seats. So like, it's actually a little better. Like I have like a digital private screening room with people that I choose to be, you know, I invite people to that film. I have their avatars and we can all talk during it and still see it on like a massive scale of a thing. And it doesn't feel that way because it's actually a tiny screen in front of your face. And I don't know if I'm advocating for virtual reality as like a, you know, a replacement for lived existence. It's not. But at the same time, there are tools to utilize that we are not utilizing. Like I might buy a ticket to a virtual reality film if that became the norm. And it's got to be the norm. It's the next step of this. It's the next step of Zoom calls. It's the next step of these watch parties. It's like, why would you go to a watch party where you have a little guy in the corner, the host, talking during it when like it's everyone in a room together watching the same piece of content?
So in a way, you're advocating for the Ready Player One society.
Not directly like Ready Player One, but I do think that we should be cognizant that all we need, as soon as we make the jump from our digital town squares taking place on Facebook as a website on a computer and start, mm-hmm. you know, in the event that virtual reality does hit mass market, does hit the mainstream, like there will not only be, I think, a more healthy distinction between the digital world and the real world. Just a better operating system for everyone. Like virtual reality can solve a lot of issues for a lot of people. Like even attending a virtual reality yoga class or like a, which is something that I've done, or chat rooms where like they put like four people in a garden together and then we like introduce ourselves and talk, and like it's weird because I'm not seeing a human face on the other side, I'm seeing like what they've crafted, but it's authentic in the sense that like everything is intentional. And I think when it comes to movies, like movies are special because of all the things, like everything that you see and everything that you hear and everything that you feel is intentional to some degree, you know, except for when it isn't. And then you have like the detached irony. But I'm a huge believer that movies are an empathy machine. And I think there's, even if we can't physically gather, there's still a way to marry the Netflix idea of consuming media and the cinema way of consuming media, because it's the same media, but the difference is in its presentation. And so if we can figure out a way to present it in a way that it commands your attention, which is, I think, is something the big screen does, and garners a sense of community, which is why we come together for movies in the first place is, you know, the thing you all have something in common, which is you all chose to see Dunkirk at 12:30 on a Sunday. And that's that gives me the warm, fuzzy feelings. Anyway, that's my feel.
So going back a little bit, what did you see in Wes Anderson, Jared Hess, Mark Webb, all these like indie filmmakers that were showing a more sensitivity side, more not necessarily hipster, but what were you seeing in them?
I think I was seeing I was seeing aesthetic more, I think, and more stylistic choices being intentionally made for the purpose of either heightening reality or grounding reality. I think like Napoleon Dynamite has a very smart score and a very smart soundtrack and a very smart color palette. It's an all around fantastic movie in my opinion, but like I think what makes it special is that it uses its color palette to bring a sense of realism to the film that like many people find Napoleon Dynamite ridiculous in a lot of ways it is, but it's presented in such a way that it is actually quite plain. And quite, you know, it feels like Idaho where the film takes place. And it feels like farmland. It feels lo-fi, despite it being, you know, like a competently made movie. And then you have on the other side, Wes Anderson, where, again, it's intentionality, it's aesthetic, it's soundtrack, it's... but with almost a completely different intention, which is to heighten reality. And in Wes Anderson's scripts, they are written with a heightened reality, whether it's a super intelligent child or a particularly complicated family or, you know, even Life Aquatic, like that whole aesthetic is made, it's a replication of reality with the intent to heighten it or you know, just hyper elevate it. Absolutely. And you know, every subsequent Wes Anderson film gets more and more Wes Anderson, and I love it. And Jared and Drew Sahess have made some flops last decade or so. Although I do sincerely wish that they had their hands on the Spider-Man Homecoming franchise, because that was, they were like in contention for that. And I was like, I want a Napoleon Dynamite Spider-Man movie.
It would have more flavor than what we currently got. We currently have.
Have you seen Gentleman Broncos?
No, I didn't.
So I guess if there's one movie I recommend to you in this podcast and listeners at home, it is 2009's Gentleman Broncos. What's that guy's name? Michael.
I'm pulling it up. Give me a second. Michael Ingarino, or something.
Yeah, he's the kid from Sky High. He was the protagonist in Sky High, and he's done some other things. But like when I saw that film, I knew him from Sky High, and I knew Jemaine Clement from Flight of the Conchords and Jennifer Coolidge. That and Sam Rockwell is in that movie. It's weird. It's gross at times. It's gross at many times, but it's like Big Fat Liar meets Napoleon Dynamite and it meets like Adult Swim. It's just weird. And I crack up. I remember, oh my God, Jennifer Coolidge, I think it's like a poop covered blow dart shot in her breasts in that movie.
What?
Yeah. They're like trying to poison someone. Because it's about like a washed up sci-fi author who steals the manuscript from Michael A's character. I don't know. I'm sorry about his name, but I don't have it in front of me.
Guy from Sky High.
And it's just cute. In fact, I may put it on after we're done with this. Maybe I'll go on Twitch and do a live stream. Hey, everyone. I'm hosting a live stream of Gentlemen Broncos right now.
So let me ask this then. What do you think of other interesting filmmakers today, like directors with strong aesthetics like Taika Waititi or...
I didn't know that Taika Waititi directed Eagle versus Shark. And Eagle versus Shark was one of the first films I ever saw on Netflix streaming in like 2009. Just because I was such a huge Flight of the Conchords fan. And I wonder if he shows up in Flight of the Conchords. I don't think he does. But it was kind of like the same circle. But as far as like filmmakers now, Greta Gerwig's almost like an old name to me. Because she's been here a while. I like the doors that she's opening up. And I think there are a lot of directors that have good brands. I know it's weird to put it that way, but...
Like, what do you mean by their brands? Like, this is their thing. Like, Greta Gerwig has her.
Yeah. So,
Noam Baumbach, you're pretty much going to get a story about marriage or divorce, that kind of thing.
Yeah. What I mean is, Wes Anderson, you're going in knowing a certain aesthetic. Greta Gerwig, you're going to go in knowing a certain aesthetic. Like David Fincher, you're going to go in with a certain aesthetic. And I think it's a little hard to get attention in that regard as a director right now. I can't think of, I mean, I'm struggling to think of any movies right now because everyone's on Twitter is screaming about Disney movies.
Mulan, you can watch it for $30
God,
on Disney Plus.
I am going to have a streaming watch party for that one. That's for sure. And it's a $3 cover for me and 10 of my closest friends.
Yay.
And if you're listening to this, you can DM me and get in on that. Everyone, let's only pay $3 for Mulan, but watch it once.
Let's do it.
I'm serious. Like 30. Yay. I get it. Like the target audience, $30. Like if there are more than three people in your household, you're coming out ahead.
If you're just a person,
don't at me, but I am going to pirate that film before I pay $30 for it. Sorry. Especially if that shit is in 4K, like 1080p. Like, not gonna happen.
Oh, yeah, that's bullshit.
Yeah, compared to 4K or whatever, like, I don't know. If it's in an extremely high quality, I'm going to steal that film before I pay $30 for it. Because
why can't we not have 4K anything on? It's Disney and HBO. They're having the same problem. Why can't we not have 4K?
I don't know. It's going to continue to get harder because Disney. One interesting conversation surrounding the whole Disney thing is whether you can. So if you buy or if you rent Mulan through Disney Plus, does Apple take its 30% cut if you are purchasing it through Apple TV, iPhone, iPad? As you would, as any other company would with any other product. Now, the issue with that is that they're not making it available for $30 through like traditional video on demand. Like you have to pay the $7 a month to get into Disney Plus, and then the $30 and then $30 to rent this one movie. It's a harder sell.
My God.
Especially considering they had already given us, like, it's not like they charged us for Hamilton, you know, or Artemis Fowl, but like how, but like,
seriously,
how,
why would we, like,
pay? Yeah, I wouldn't have paid for that. It's astounding to me that they were planning to put Hamilton out next holiday season, like holiday 2021. And then they were sitting on a, what would had that point had been over 5 year old footage. Cause like, yeah, that is just ridiculous. Like, you're showing us, like, it's hard for me to like even appreciate Hamilton. One, because I didn't finish seeing it. My friends didn't want to finish it. And two, it's such a relic of its time. Like, it's like, oh, this was made shortly before Trump's election. That makes sense. Like this is very much a Obama's America production. And in more ways than one, not just like in terms of its music or its casting, but how it treats and addresses problematic US history through like this, like, everything works if you just believe in the system.
We tried and we're still doing Zoom
calls. It's like, thank you for the film, thank you for the musical, and it's a objectively great musical.
Its style alone and how it mixes, you know, all these different art forms and even genres of music, I mean, in on itself is, you know, deserves its high praise. By the way, I've also not finished Hamilton because I didn't realize it was going to be a 2-hour and 45-minute musical.
Yeah.
And I'm already not like a huge theater person. So, so I was like, I'll come back to this a different time. I'll come back when I have a spare 3 hours to kill. When I get done with my Love, Victor, High Fidelity, and all the other stuff. So for you, I guess we'll kind of round it out here a little bit, not end it, but let's kind of get into the third quarter here. What would you say was the most influential? Like, what was the one thing, or if there's a set of things, like part of media or movie or anything has said, this is going to be me?
I know the feeling, like when you come out, like it's the feeling that everyone wants, I think. Or every like hardcore film fan wants when they come out of a movie, is like not just the feeling that they watch something that they enjoyed, but they watched something that they felt that they could aspire to do. Like the feeling of like coming out of a theater so excited that you run home to write a new story. Even if that story, you know, doesn't materialize the next day, it's all about like that excited feeling coming home. You know, whether that's like,
to be fair, if I had to answer, it would be a long answer.
Yeah. I mean, it's a long answer because that feeling has come up so many times in my life and I'm lucky for that. You know, like I don't even know how to there we go.
Tyler.
So sorry about the crash. I'm a writer. I think a lot of media kind of affirms that for me, and like the things that I look for in media is the writing, and I'll always follow the strong screenplay, and I think movies that made me want to go out and hunt down the screenplay, like Social Network, like Scott Pilgrim, they informed me on a new craft, like on how to architecture, you know, how to be the architect of a story and character. And that's always going to be what I take away. It's always going to be what I take away from movies, and it's up to artists to make inspiring things, I suppose. I don't know.
It is. All right. Well, on a final note, so what is the? I'll end on an easier one. What are some of your favorite movies?
I love Toy Story. I love Big. I love the first Alien. I love Social Network's Scott Pilgrim. I love Mad Max Fury Road. I love Her, Spike Jonze. I love most Spike Jonze movies. I love Charlie Kaufman movies, adaptation, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Being John Malkovich. Those are all just like my shit. And I'm so stoked that Charlie Kaufman has a film on the way. Charlie Kaufman has a movie coming to Netflix, and so does Aaron Sorkin.
David Fincher.
David Fincher. I'm going to be eating good for a while.
All right, well, just to kind of bring everything to a close, thank you so much, Tyler, for this one-on-one chat. Do you have a I don't think you have a podcast, but do you have a blog?
Yeah, I can plug some stuff. You can find me on Twitter at Tyler Scruggs and Instagram at Scruggernaut, Scruggernaut. Read what I'm doing at tylerscruggs.com or subscribe to the Substack, and then patreon.com/tylerscruggs for that exclusive content, that behind the scenes content, that risque content that I don't want the public to see. Sometimes not really, but you can find me there.
I'll post the OnlyFans account on the description below.
Thank you very much.
Gotta eat. Yes.
Thank you so much for having me, Kale.
You're welcome. Thank you, everyone. You can find me at Twitter on Movie Kale, and that's pretty much it. Thank you, Tyler. And we will end here.